vibraphonist Louis Ramirez and his Latin Jazz Ensemble with Latin Blues. This is from his 1986 album, paying tribute to fellow jazz phenom and fellow vibraphonist Cal Jada, who died while performing in Manila, the Philippines, on May the 5th, 1982. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and we have a lot to talk about on this edition of Free Your Mind Friday. This week gave us more than enough fodder to last us a whole year. So let's get to it at 888-874-4888. I'd ask if you can tighten it up a little bit. We have quite a few people wanting to talk today, and just do a little editing so we can have you say what you need to say and still have room for others to come in on the conversation as well. Joel from South Carolina, you start us off today.
Hi, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. I heard, by the way, that you would hurt your arm, but I'm not too worried for you because you are known worldwide for your steadfastness and resilience. So I'm not going to offer you much sympathy and just tell you to get better quickly. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you so
You're
much.
You're welcome. You know, I've been traveling a lot over the last year, all over, you know, three continents. So that's why I really haven't really called, but I've been listening on occasion to the archives. And what I'd like to talk about today, and I'll try to talk as quickly as possible so others can contribute, is a conversation that you had with Charles Ortel about 2 or 3 months ago. I might just say in preface to what my remarks that I think that the 15 or 20 times or so that Ortel has appeared on your program have been quite extraordinary. I think in some ways he's an anomaly in the financial world. He's really a kind of representative of the paleoconservative point of view. And with his long background in capital finance, I think he's really appalled at the personal corruption that we've seen really over the last 20 or 30 years. In finance, he deserves tremendous credit for exposing the Clintonian racketeering and all that it represents, as well as for his work in the past when he exposed GE and AIG. So that said, I want to criticize him for what he had to say in your program about 3 months ago. He said two things that really set my hair on edge. The first thing he talked about was the fact that that the military budget only represents a small percentage of the GDP. And while that is true in a technical sense, it's really been an argument and a ruse of the conservative movement for as long as I can remember that it's really a small amount of all the spending that we do on goods and services over the course of the year. But it belies the fact that we're spending close to $1 billion when you count in, you know, nuclear weapons and all of the energy requirements that are in the Energy Department. So, in fact, the amount of money that is being poured into defense is monumental. And it's really, really awful for the economy as well. It's unlike, it doesn't have a multiplier effect that, like, economists like to talk about. For instance, if you build a car, keeping aside the problems of burning fossil fuels, if you build a car, you still have a use car market that you can send cars to, and there are many ancillary industries that are built to coordinate with people driving cars on the highway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't have that with weapons. If you build, let's say, an Abrams fighting vehicle or an F-15 fighter plane, if those things are damaged, you have to build new ones, and there isn't a used plane market for weapons that have already been used, and that money all comes from the taxpayer. So the military budget has really, in many ways, been an economic disaster for the United States. I must tell you, Teresa, I have gone around the country for the whole year, and all I have seen is just the most astonishing immiseration. It's almost hard to describe it, the kind of misery that I've seen in this country, not only in urban areas, which you all know about, but in rural areas. It's absolutely devastating. And much of that comes from the fact that so much of our budgetary expenses are poured into the military. So I think in some ways that's a rationale for accepting militarism. And if you don't ask, I haven't said anything about the moral consequences of the egregious use of military power, but that should be self-evident to all PRN listeners. The second thing I wanted to mention is that in talking about the economic crisis, which is why you had him on that that day, you didn't really talk about the Clinton Foundation that day, but rather about the coming economic collapse. He spent a lot of time talking about propensity on the part of the ordinary American consumer to spend recklessly, if you remember that. And the need for frugality is really, really important for the American consumer. While that is to a certain extent true, that too is a ruse that conservatives have used for many, many decades. The problem is really with the consumer and the lack of consumer discipline. Yet he said nothing, absolutely nothing, about the deliberate attempt on the part of corporate industry and corporate finance to outsource millions of jobs, almost 30 million in the last 40 years, and to deindustrialize the country with the implications and consequences that all of that represents. So there was nothing about that at all. And instead,
but you would appreciate, I think you would appreciate, though, that the focus of our discussion was what people should be thinking now ahead of things getting even worse.
Well, of course.
To reorganize or restructure themselves in such a way that they have some degree of control over the few pennies that you have, you know, how to be in charge of your financial life. So in a sense, I would say he was speaking specifically to that point and didn't go far out because we were sticking to the topic. There's a crisis coming. There's a collapse on its way. Here are the things you need to think about, and you need to get to it quickly.
Usually I want to get off, but I agree with that, except that, again, the causes of the crisis have less to do with consumer spending and more to do with the financial power elite, which deliberately caused it. And the last thing I wanted to say was that he engaged in a really powerful attack against socialism, as you might say. You might say, we've never had socialism in the United States. We never will. He's certainly entitled to his polemic. We all are. But he's dead wrong on the history. And I would suggest to him that he take a listen to Professor Jeffries, who was on your program a number of times a few years ago, who's a real expert in labor history, who might set him right on this. We have had a long tradition of socialism in this country. We had over 20 socialist mayors in this country at the end of World War I. And many of the much of the legislation, whether it be local or state or federal in this country, has all come from the socialist movement. Eugene Debs was the socialist candidate for president in 1912, and without having any money to campaign, he still polled 2 million votes. The magazine In the Masses was a daily magazine that had a circulation, socialist magazine that had a circulation of over 2 million, 2 million people, and 2 million readers, I should say. And there were many, many other journals and magazines that had huge circulation. There were general strikes in this country in 1920, and even as late as 1946. The reason why we don't have socialist governments in this country right now, small socialist governments, is because of government repression. We had two red scares, and Professor Jeffries talked about this. We had one in 1919 and 1920 that lasted through the 20s, and then the red scare that started in
1946. I think you're talking, by the way, about Gerald Horn.
No, I was thinking of Jeffries was talking about the history of socialism in the United States, the history of labor movements and its effect upon black people. He had mentioned this very, very extensively. So Mr. Rothschild completely missed all of this. And you know, in many ways, I understand this. Even on the left, a writer like Matt Taibbi, who writes for Rolling Stone, who's written great work exposing the criminal proclivities of people like Lloyd Blankfein, Goldman Sachs, and the heads of Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase. And he's right that, you know, that they're individually corrupt people in these institutions, but it's a systemic corruption that is behind it all. If there was no Lloyd Blankfein or no Jamie Dimon, there would be others who would be involved in this. So that's the point I want to make. I think that Ortel has done a great service and continues to do a great service by exposing the Clintonian racketeering. But like all, and by the way, his conservatism reminds me of the conservatism that we see in Oliver Stone's great film Wall Street, where the mentor to the young actor, Martin Sheen's son, I forget his name now, who plays the young stockbroker, is mentored by Hal Holbrook, who again believes that it's all about individual corruption and not systemic corruption. So I think those are all important points that Mr. Ortel missed and that I thought I would bring up today.
All right. I will pass it along. Thanks so much for getting us started today. Marie from Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good afternoon again. You stirred me up with the word immigrant yesterday. And thank you for doing that. I decided to look in the dictionary to see what immigrant means. It means someone who enters into another country. And with our race, African Americans, we were always referred as slaves, not immigrants. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And you're the second one I heard has mentioned that we were immigrants, not, you know, the other way around or something. So I
we were on both sides of that word. Mostly, we were brought into the United States as enslaved people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, with the years, in the ensuing years, when many countries became independent that historically were tied to the United States through the slave trade, those countries now independent, their people sought to move to other countries, but not as slaves.
Mm-hmm.
They would travel to further their education, to live a better life, to work and get money, to send home and maintain their families back home. So when they came to the United States, don't forget now, a couple of hundred years came in between the period of slavery and the period in which you had people coming from the Caribbean and Africa as immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So they were both slaves, enslaved people coming from Africa. And then with the ensuing years, many, many years passed, many of these countries became independent, like Ghana, Kenya, and so forth. In the Caribbean, Barbados, Trinidad, Jamaica, they became independent countries. We could argue about whether that is actually true or whether it was just a word we use without truly understanding the facts of it. But they were able to come out of those countries as independent people and therefore entering other countries as immigrants. We had a large movement from the Caribbean to Britain, for example. I would argue that in many cases, the nurses who went to Britain saved its health system there. We had that kind of movement. So we have two distinct areas in which you could categorize people leaving the Caribbean, leaving the African continent, but under entirely different circumstances.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We have Tom from Connecticut. You're on the air.
Given the anxieties and everything about the health care bill and the issues surrounding that, And people that would offer the idea that healthcare is a basic right. I'm always curious as to what responsibilities they think attaches to that right. And I think that even if it became Medicare for All or whatever formulation people came up with, how can our country not be crushed under the weight of the obesity epidemic trying to deal with the expenses that revolve around that kind of care?
Well, of course, that's a very difficult question to answer because obesity by itself is not the major cause of an epidemic. We have diseases that work in concert with other maladies in the body. It is not just obesity. It's not just diabetes. It's diabetes and other complications. It's not just heart disease. It's not just stroke. So when you're talking about the impact of any particular disease, you have to look at disease in general as a systemic problem. And it's not unique to the United States, as you know.
Well, no, but is the systemic problem also tied to lifestyle issues that people think they cannot be dictated to in any way?
But they're not just lifestyle issues. This is what I'm trying to say. These things are very complicated discussions. It's no one thing that causes a person to die. You know, you look at how a disease functions or impacts other things going on in the body and outside the body. You'd be amazed, for example, about the role of stress killing off hundreds of thousands of people every year. Just stress. It causes so much malfunction, but people don't consider it part of the medical profile that they ought to be talking about and trying to fix as a disease. So we have to have a more holistic and comprehensive view of disease. We need to even recalibrate our notions of what is disease. You know, so we have so many scientific studies that point up a whole different profile than the one that you're talking about. There are people, I've read studies about people being raised in cultures where they tend to be heavier, but they're healthy, and they're outliving all these people who are at their ideal weight and eating very carefully and whatnot, but they're dying early. So it's a very complex thing when you're talking about disease. And I understand that we ought to be concerned about obesity, but obesity not as somebody's fault. Obesity would be naturally occurring in any part of the world if people are eating what they're eating. And sometimes, even if they eat right, they'll still be obese because that is the pattern and the imprint that began years and years ago. Because, let's say, in preparation for winter, their bodies are accustomed to storing fat, or if they come from people who had a particular kind of life or line of work, they tended to accumulate more fat than the average person. Sometimes it is not always the case that an obese person or someone we call obese is actually obese in the way we define it. They may be heavier. They have a different body shape. They have a different body mass index. But they're healthy.
But things now exist that never existed in this world before, be it a food supply, be it whatever predispositions people have to a particular body type. I have friends who work in hospital and nursing home situations where they're so hard pressed now to even find beds, and they have these hoists to have to accommodate folks now. This is just a rippling effect of costs that whatever the... I have a hard time believing that everyone who you would characterize in the way that you have done has no choice in trying to control their weight.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying let's not assume the opposite is always true. I'm saying let's take an intelligent view of this whole obsession that the United States has with weight and body shaming and all this other kind of stuff. We understand. We grown people, we understand that it is better not to be fat. It's better not to be obese. But we also have to understand how obesity occurs in our country. And is it the case always that somebody who is heavier is also sick automatically?
No, but the demographic is tending in that direction, given the general nature of heart disease, of diabetes.
You can go the other way. You can say that people who are skinny and at the right weight also are ill. I'm waiting for us to understand as a nation. Let's get away from the characterization and the personalization and deal with the condition and the disease itself. There are people who are heavy and perfectly healthy.
Not disputing that at all.
I'm sorry?
I'm not disputing that at all.
Yeah, but we don't hear about that. We don't hear about the people who are eating more than the recommended number of calories a day and are perfectly healthy because in their line of work, that's what they need to eat. I mean, could you imagine a wrestler being...
But folks like that are not adding to the enormous costs of health care. People like that are fine. They're not putting pressure on the system that's horribly flawed anyway.
There are lots of things putting pressure on the system that have nothing to do with the choices that people individually are making.
Yes, if you get into the next slide.
You have a polluted environment. You have processed foods. You have the issue of stress. You have the issue of poverty. You have all kinds of stressors that are increasingly being evidenced in maladies and maladjustments in people, and that is understandable.
But
if you look at the fat intake of a Swede living in the country, which is very high fat intake, and you look at somebody who's doing all the right things in a typical American urban society, urban location, you may be surprised to know that the Swede is healthier, far healthier, though you would think on the surface that diet is more atrocious than the other person who's eating all the right things. So I am saying, in my observation, we have allowed ourselves to move away from the core subject, which is how do we achieve optimal health and how do we persuade the government, since it has responsibility for much of the regulation around health, how do we do that?
The Farm Bill and all that is horrific. The distortions in government policies are easily to be taken to task. That's an easy mark also.
Not at all. At one time, the government was the chief agent of misinformation about health.
Yes. And when it was trying to be fixed, I can't remember the committee in 68 that suggested less meat in the diet, and everyone in meat-eating states was voted out of office. All these reports that would suggest mitigation of various factors in our diets, not supported by farm bills and subsidies and everything else, are vilified, and the information never got to the public. Gary Noll's idea of the food pyramid that he presented to Congress, I believe, was marginalized, tragically. So, yes.
All I'm asking for is that we become less dogmatic and more rational in our collective discussion about health. I find it's very often it's tyrannical. I mean, people go into these extremes and they become totally dogmatic about it. That's not a way you reach people and teach people. And body shaming and people who, you have young kids committing suicide very often because they are troubled in school and they're attacked and they're called fat and ugly and all. I mean, it's a huge subject matter, and it does not help when the people who can help become tyrannical and dogmatic about it. It seems that we have not yet been able to arrive at a point of rational discussion. You are either an idiot and have to be told what to do in order to be, quote, healthy, or you just turn everything off and become unhealthy because you're not paying attention to what is being offered to you to understand how you change things a little bit. We have this problem. It's a huge problem. The people who are best suited to do the job of teaching this nation how to do things differently are so tyrannical. They are so obsessive. It's almost alienating that they shut down the discussion before it even opens up. And they're not willing to absorb responsibility for the fact they're turning people off. And you see it when you have a chance. Look at how many young people, teenagers, have been killing themselves. And the people who should be reaching them and teaching them are so self-satisfied, being in their ivory towers, looking down at the battlefield to see how many more they have killed off and turned off. That's the dilemma we have. If you are able to reach a kid, to reach an older person, you talk to them differently. You present your information in a non-threatening, non-dogmatic way. And you don't tell people they're stupid because they're fat.
No.
There are a lot of people who are skinny and at the ideal weight, but who wants to be around them? They're crazy. They're maladjusted. You know, can't we just get to a point where we could sit down and talk without somebody telling me, you know, I lack self-esteem, or I am abandoning my own self, or I will die next week Tuesday because I didn't ration my meals and stuff like that. No, we are grown people. And I despise dogmatism. I really hate it. Because
and
it has
do
done
I.
more damage than any of the other things that people should be telling us. They have undermined their own revolution by doing this. You know, you go to the supermarket. I don't know if this has happened to you. It's happened to me. Go to the supermarket, and somebody is watching you like a hawk, what you're putting in your cart. And very often they would, you know, become rude enough and obnoxious enough to presume to tell me that, you know, how much phosphorus this has and how many, you know, and I just, all I'm thinking is I would like to meet you in the parking lot and smack you silly.
Well,
because you're rude and obnoxious. You know, if you want to speak to me, speak to me. But you don't have to go through all of that stuff to feel self-righteous. I'll show you self-righteous right in the parking lot. I'm talking nonsense now. It's time for me to quit. But you know what I mean?
You're freeing your
mind. We have a disaster on our hands. We do. We have a crisis on our hands. We do. And believe me, I know it very well. Okay? So what we need more than anything else is for people to know how to talk to people and convey the information without all of the slights and put downs and whatnot. You don't need that.
No, confrontation and shaming does not open anyone's mind, shaming them. That's ridiculous. But that's sadly the tactic that the self-righteous that you refer to take most of the time. It's hard to find a kind, nurturing message to try and change someone's attitude, which has probably been armored over time anyway.
But that's not true. Yeah, we have seen enough examples that have changed the minds of people and that caused a ripple effect of them in turn changing other people's minds and attitudes and ways of living in a very positive way. But I tell you, take a look. In the last month alone, I've read stories from about four kids killing themselves. You know, that is, by the way, a health crisis.
Oh,
shooting
absolutely.
Each other. That is a public health crisis. But we stop at the business of what we're eating. So we're not having an intelligent response to a crisis. We have people chewing off this piece over here, and they become the, quote, experts in that area, disregarding completely that they're possibly insufficient in the way they're responding. We just have to get more intelligent about this business of discussing health and willing the people who have the skills and the knowledge, who have the ability to convey these things, to get them to do it differently. I don't want to hate somebody who is trying to put me on the right path, but you're turning me off. And I would rather live with one leg than put up with a lecture or so from you at any time. I would rather do it.
That's a bit extreme, you treat.
It's a bit extreme, but I really dislike it intensely. Because in the end, what they're doing is for their own edification. It's their ego needs over, they choose that over the mission to educate people. And that means you first have to have humanity. If you don't have humanity, get out of the business. Go learn how to fix cars or do something else where you don't have to interact with people. Because a lot of people don't realize it, but they're doing a great deal of damage because they're attacking people's psyche. And you can't possibly become healthy when your psyche is messed up.
It's under duress. That's
my take on it. I really do wish. I mean, you could listen to Gary Null and instantly tell there is a different approach to health and healing than some of these jokers out here. And they're doing a lot of damage. They're doing a lot of damage, destroying people, making them feel unvalued. I've seen it. A friend of mine once was very sick, and she'd been, you know, she went to all these lectures and so forth, and she was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. I said, look, the first thing you got to do is stop going to these damn lectures, because they're destroying you. They're not giving you information in a way that you could embrace it and use it to your benefit. The lectures are being held in order to establish this lecturer's career in this area, that he's the God, the new God to listen to. And half the stuff that he's saying is just junk. The first thing you have to do is buy a pair of sneakers and run like hell away from people like that.
Because well, Trace, I didn't think I was going to erect such a soapbox for you this afternoon, but wonderful conversation.
I mean, it's the thing is, it's true. And at a time when people desperately need, it's not just the information, it's how it's delivered. Sure. Is this person truly connected to the problem that you are experiencing? Is this person even a human being? Many of them are in the business to make money. They could care less whether you drop dead in the parking lot.
Yes. How many new diet titles are released every year to the wanting masses looking for the magic whatever?
No, it's the United States. You have so many charlatans operating in all these spheres of influence, and about in any one area, you'd find that the number of people who really know what they're doing and who really understand how to deliver the knowledge that they have, it's very low. But the side effects are that they are actually destroying people and giving them the view that there aren't very many options except those that they give you. And that's wrong. It's a whole messed up world out there. Thanks. Great talking with you today. And thank you for calling and contributing. Thank you. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon, Utrice. How are you today?
I'm hanging in. How about you?
I'm very good. Listen, two quick questions. Number one, now that it seems like Mueller is putting together an investigation into Trump, number one, will they find anything damaging that will hopefully lead to that clown being placed out of office? And number two, afterwards, will they then start an investigation into Hillary Rodham Clinton in regards to her dirty shenanigans that have done more damage than honestly I think Trump has around the world?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I don't have any particular faith in the system. I don't. Because the first question I would ask was, how come it took so long? Why wasn't there a grand jury impaneled when Comey had the ability to do it? Even our great Attorney General Jeff Sessions had the ability to do it. Nobody is talking about Hillary Clinton. And that's because the understanding existed, it started so many years ago, that she was not to be touched. And we're crazy to think that it's about whether Trump had some dealings or meddlings with the Russians. No. We have to accept the fact about what is going on here. And what is going on here is, and I say this, as you know, I am not a Trump fan. I am not. But we are seeing unfolding very slowly, but very methodically, what seems to be a plan to get this guy and destroy him utterly. Because Trump unknowingly entered territory he was not supposed to enter. He is such a loose cannon. He's like Mr. Magoo. You know, he's causing all kinds of hell and damnation all around him. And he just keeps going and continuing his life by his own definition. This is the situation here. There's great interest by several sectors of this country that must, this is their feeling, that they have to destroy him. Because he has entered into places he did not belong. Because of Trump, they have to now pay attention to Hillary. That was not supposed to happen, and it was purely accidental. It's not like Trump sat down and designed it. But the way things happened politically, it actually put him in the position to call for these investigations when it would never have happened otherwise. So he fumbled and bumbled his way. And I think to some degree, they consider him the perfect guy to do it. But he's a marked man. From the very beginning, he was a marked man.
Yeah, but you
this don't... system, the system is made up of all these factions that have been accustomed to threatening presidents, assassinating presidents, carrying out, basically running a parallel government. They're accustomed to doing that. Killing people, making people disappear. They are accustomed to doing that. The situation with Trump has just now made all of that necessary to be publicly pursued and prosecuted. That they don't like.
Yeah, but
silence? You, yes. But you, operating in the dark? Yes. They don't like all of this spectacle.
But
go ahead.
You know, Therese, the thing that gets me the most is that America has this moral high ground in regards to Russia. When they go all around this world and they do the same thing and worse, there's not a country over in Central America that America hasn't played the role in their election. As far as being underhanded, putting in people that wasn't in the best interest of their country, but in the best interest of American interest. And they do that all around the world. And now everybody is so morally upset because there may be a possibility that Russia may have done that to America. And you know, it's sickening.
But
it's,
really,
it's ridiculous.
Don't we know that this is how it has been for a very, very long time?
Yeah, we know that.
And
most Americans
exempt.
Don't know that. Most
of course
Americans
they do.
don't understand. No, they don't, Utrecht, because if they understood it, they wouldn't be reacting in the manner in which they're reacting to this situation and making it seem like it's the worst thing that has ever happened to America and around the world, because, a.k.a., It's dealing with democracy. It's hurting democracy. And this is what the real true issue is. We're a hypocritical nation that does some of the most dastardliest things in the world, but then we try to act like we have a moral ground.
Yes, because we are conditioned. We have a media whose job it is, that's what propaganda is, on a national and international basis, to paint a totally unreal situation and then to have people believe it. This has been going on, as you know, for decades and decades. So it is very hard for people who can't bring themselves to believe that the government will do wrong things and bad things and evil things. It's very hard for people to depart from that way of thinking. This is my country. My country can't behave this way. My country doesn't behave this way. This is the United States of America. We have a whole different point of reference. We are the really good people of the earth. Now, there are people who still believe that. You could talk Paul and preach Saul, and they will believe this until the day they die. You cannot get most people to believe that President Clinton was running one of the biggest drug and gun running operations out of Arkansas. You can't get people to believe that. He preceded Oliver North in this business. You cannot get people to believe that.
Well,
and he's never been prosecuted. He's never been even investigated on this matter. You cannot get people to believe that. You can't get people to believe that Hillary Clinton is as evil as she is. You can't. Because if you look at how people prepare for elections or how people in politics, where they spend their money, a huge part of that budget is for media. That's how they make money.
You're wrong, Eutrice. You're wrong.
Okay.
You need to clarify and say, and it's for white media. It's not for black media or Latino media or any other media. It's for white media because they don't spend no money whatsoever. Black.
I know that.
Okay.
I know that.
You have a good weekend. I got to run. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Thank you, Eutrice. We have a short time, but
yes.
I would like to talk about a lot of things. I know there's no time for it, but I want to get in the most important point that people should take away with this discussion, with all the members of your seminar today. You know, people ought to think, number one, you did talk about mission. And we have to bring that to the mission. And the mission is a mission that is formulated by the oligarchy that we have to understand runs the country. And it runs the country in their interests and not in the interests of the millions or hundreds of millions of people who live here. And whether we're talking about nutrition, whether we're talking about the various public policy things that have to do with infrastructure and what goes on in the country, we have to recognize that this country is run by the oligarchy, even though we pretend to be a republic and we pretend to be a democracy. And you can't have a democracy and have a rapacious capitalism at the same time. But most people are fooled. I think the goal of the oligarchy that runs things here has a very important mission, and that mission is to make profit for itself, and that's it. the people that live here, they have to control those people. In order to do that, you have to have means of information, which is given in the schools and in the media. And a lot of it is just propaganda, and they can't talk about the things that people need to know. So one of the most important things they use is racism, the white supremacy racism, which is in full effect in the United States of America. They, in these schools, they don't teach the children about anthropology and why people look different, and they don't teach about phenotypes and how they came to be that way. They don't teach about how all people at some time in history came from Africa, and they went to different places in the world, and as they went to different places, after thousands and tens and tens of thousands of years, their intersection of their genetic background and the environmental conditions they lived in changes the way they look, their phenotype. So the ruling class is very good at divide and conquer. You cannot run this place in your interests if you were not able to divide people, and that's what they do. They divide people. They have each a group at the other group's throat, and that's the way they can run things in their interests. If things were run right for the interests of the people, there would be no problems about what's going to happen with the taxes that people pay. We wouldn't be paying nearly $1 trillion, close to it, a year to send to the ruling class people who make planes and tanks and all the implements of war and engage in operations all over the world, robbing people of their resources and labors to make profit. The people here would live a much better life, but as long as you have this system of capitalism, as long as you have a small group of people in charge, as long as you have no representation, these people in so-called representative groups like Congress and state legislative bodies, they don't represent the interests of the people. They represent the interests of the ruling class. People have to get that through their head, and they're not going to get in school. They have to do whatever is necessary, which means, to me, studying on your own to find these things out. You can go to elementary school up to the pile higher and deeper degree, PhD, and you won't learn anything about this because those in charge are so involved in keeping you ignorant about what is really going on and ignorant about things that are done in their interests and not in the interests of the people who live here.
I don't disagree with anything that you have just said. I think you're 100% spot on. That's for sure. We really have to, and this is why this program exists, and this is why the station exists. We really must encourage a lot of talking. It is one of the best weapons we have, and we don't seem to really understand the value of it. Or they think, well, a program is, you know, here's this guy saying this, and here's that guy saying that. Well, that's nice. It's good to have people who have specialized knowledge in things. But I value more than anything else the ability of people to talk with each other, wrestle with a problem. You don't have to be right. It's not about being right. It's about exchanging views. You would be surprised about how much information is disseminated right here on Lead Stories from people who have an entirely different perspective. This is great education. And it's peer-to-peer education. You don't get it anywhere. You don't get it frequently enough, that's for sure. So let's value this time that we spend with each other and think out loud. As
Absolutely.
I said, I don't have to be right, and you don't have to be right. We just have to be interested in talking to each other. So thank you all for making this consistent effort to keep our conversation at a particular level. We are doing good work. This is very strong political work, and I am grateful for the fact that you honor that in your approach to the program and what you see as a way to make a contribution. So I thank you for the spirit in which you offer your thoughts. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus, a person absolutely worth listening to. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. This is the weekend. Get yourself surrounded by people who mean you well and bring you joy and positive dimension into your life, and run like heck away from people who don't. We see each other on Monday. Until then, please know that it is a pleasure and a great privilege to me to be in your company. Bye-bye.